Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to Tennis Podcast.
Well, we have quite the weekend coming your way here on Roland Garros Relived from the Tennis Podcast, because we are going back to 1999, and that is our sole concentration for the next couple of shows, starting with Steffi Graf against Martina Hingis. Tomorrow it's going to be Andre Agassi against Andre Medvedev. Catherine, Matt, when we drew this up, these two days were pretty much at the front of the queue, weren't they? I mean, it was such a difficult shortlist to draw up. There's some wonderful matches and memories that didn't make the cut of 15 matches we're covering in this series. But these two, there was never a moment that was not going to happen, Catherine.
Yeah, absolutely. They're two matches that have, I mean, people knew it was great at the time. Looking back on, you know, write-ups of both finals and reflecting on the tournament, people knew that a special finals weekend had just played out. But even so, they've both taken on more significance and more intrigue as time has passed. And of course, you've also got the added story of the two winners ending up married after the weekend, and thankfully still married, which is just, yeah, you couldn't write it. I mean, you could write it, but
you'd have to have a pretty vivid imagination, wouldn't you? And then it was real life. So very cool. And the matches themselves, the storylines, they both had everything, really. And the one we've just witnessed between Steffi Graf and Martina Hingis, we have had a whale of a time over the last couple of hours. Just the sounds coming out of us as we watch those two players duking it out. There's just so much that goes on between Steffi Graf and Martina Hingis in the 1999 final. So what else was happening in 1999? The euro was introduced in 11 countries. Bill Clinton was acquitted in his impeachment trial. And the Millennium Dome opened in London, now known as the O2 Arena. Ever been to the Millennium Dome, either of you?
Well, yeah, for the tennis.
Before the O2 Arena became a tennis venue.
No. Well, everyone said it was rubbish, didn't they?
See, I would take issue with that.
Well, here we go.
Everybody did say it was rubbish. You're right. But I went another day there, and I thought it was great fun.
Was it not loads of stuff. Really cold?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cold. Although I think, I don't know when I went. I think I might have gone at Easter or something, and they'd probably ironed out a few of the gremlins, and there were quite a few of those early on. But I mean, it was immediately obvious when you walked in that this should be a sporting arena. I don't think it wasn't being talked about as one at the time, but it just felt like what it ended up becoming. So I'm really glad that they managed to make of it what they have. In the tennis world and getting into this French Open final, you've got Martina Hingis, aged 18. She was the world number one. She'd already won 5 Grand Slam tournaments, including the most recent one at the Australian Open. Steffi Graf was 29. 7 years had passed since her narrow defeat to Monica Seles that we were talking about a couple of days ago. She'd already won 21 Grand Slam singles titles, but was clearly nearing the end. She'd missed 4 Grand Slam tournaments with injury, and would only play one more major tournament after this French Open. And Matt, on the eve of it, I mean, they'd gone very different routes to get to the final. Hingis had just been sweeping all before her. She'd had no problems at all to beat Arantxa Sánchez Vicario in the semi-finals straight sets, whereas Graf was having to fight tooth and nail. She beat Seles in three sets. Every round she played, I think, didn't she beat Davenport in a long one as well? I mean, it was a real struggle for her to get to the final. She also beat a young Anna Kournikova as well, who was playing pretty well at that time. And between the two of them, there was a bit of needle, I seem to recall.
There was, yes. Just another point is that Martina Hingis beat Emily Maresma in round two, which was a repeat of that year's Australian Open final. Just incredible that they would then meet so early at the next slam. But yes, there was some needle because the backstory is that lots of people believe that Hingis's success at the slams from 97 onwards came partly or perhaps largely because Steffi Graf was less of a factor, because Graf was having lots of injury trouble, I think, on her knee and her back and her wrist. She had all sorts of problems, and Hingis therefore had a route through and obviously played brilliant tennis but didn't have to go through Graf so much. And Hingis didn't really like that narrative, obviously, and she had a few swipes at Graf, actually, just before this final. She said that Steffi has had some results in the past, but it's a faster, more athletic game now. She's old. Her time is past. Oh. And she also said she's just a runner who never gives up.
When did she say that?
This was before the final.
Crikey.
Oh, my God.
And Graf was not getting involved in any of that narrative whatsoever. She says, I don't feel like I have anything to prove, which I thought was interesting to compare now to Serena. I think I could be wrong. Maybe Serena has said something like that, but it's always felt like she's always thought that she still has something to prove, even in the back end of her career, and even though she doesn't. And Graf said that she only entered Roland Garros really to sharpen her will for Wimbledon. She wasn't in that much form, not much was expected of her on the clay, and yet she got through to the final. So yeah, that's the backdrop for the final. Just perfectly poised, I think.
I think in defense of Martina Hingis's spectacular arrogance, and it is one of the most, the arrogance that she had during those 206 weeks when she was world number one, for me, it was one of the most sort of likable brands of arrogance, because there was sort of youthful naivety to it almost. But in her defense, slightly, the NBC broadcast, which we've just watched, they were obsessed with Steffi Graf being old as well. I mean, for me, it's far more remarkable that Martina Hingis was 18 years of age and playing this match as a multi-Grand Slam champion than it was that Steffi Graf was 29 years of age and still contesting for a Grand Slam title. They were bowled over by the fact that the aging 29-year-old Steffi Graf was still in Grand Slam finals. And to be fair to that, they ran an interview clip with Graf from prior to the final, and there was a very surprising air of vulnerability about her. I mean, which I rarely remember seeing. You know, she delivered a similar line to the one that Matt just said about how low her expectations had been for the tournament, but just in the sort of slight quiver in her voice, there just wasn't the same level of conviction, and that was very evident in the first set. I think it was such a different Steffi Graf to the one we saw against Monica Seles in 92.
Just on the age point, though, it was a very different time. If you consider that what Hingis achieved when she won three Grand Slams in a year is the equivalent of Coco Gauff now going and winning three Grand Slams in a year. That's the age we're talking about. Steffi Graf at 29 had already had 13, 14 years at the top level of the game, whereas now you'd be looking to pretty much peak around about 28, 29. I think there's just been that shift, really, in terms of career and career expectancy, really, of when you come into your own. But
tell that to Martina Hingis, David.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Back then, everybody came into their own as a mid-teenager or a late teenager. If you think of Capriati, Seles and Hingis and Venus and Serena, this and Steffi herself, this is what happened back then. Coco Gauff feels like such an outlier right now. That feels unusually young to be making these sort of strides. But you're right. I mean, and Graf, relatively speaking, was seen as one of the older players. That said, that is still a spectacularly rude thing to say in a press conference ahead of playing the all-time great Steffi Graf. I mean, it's hilarious, and I absolutely love it. And I personally was an enormous fan of Martina Hingis, from the way she played the game through to the way she carried herself, because it was just so funny half the time. The way you laughed, Catherine, when Matt was reading that quote, that pretty much mirrors the reactions that we all had during probably half a dozen moments of the match, where Hingis is... I can't really believe what I'm seeing half the time. Her, the way she reacts to stuff, the sort of petulance, the precociousness of her, the way she walks about as if she owns the place, and she can't believe that. My sense is she can't believe this old woman at the other end of the court is winning anything, winning any points, you know. And there's some. I mean, in the first set, she absolutely dismantles Graf, and there are points where they might have an exchange that ends on a Graf forehand winner. And whilst the ball is still flying past Hingis, Hingis is complaining and mocking herself because she's given her a forehand to hit. She's engaged in a forehand rally, as if to say, why on earth did I just do that? I mean, of course she's going to hit a forehand winner off that. If I give her anything else, she hasn't got a chance. This is ridiculous. What am I doing? And it just, every single raise of the eyebrow, laugh at herself, arms in the air, it all communicates. It's so funny to watch.
Yeah, she wasn't interested in giving her opponent any credit whatsoever. And she got a remarkable whatever face, which she uses a lot.
Exactly. She's a brat. She's an absolute brat in that match.
Great face. I think maybe... I'm going to be overly sympathetic towards the behaviour of Martina Hingis because I find it so relatable. The RC teenager in me was watching that going, well, yeah, that's how I would have reacted too. And, you know, I love that she lets you in on exactly how she's feeling and doesn't try to mask it or filter it in any way, both like with her face or with her comments. You know, this is the woman that was responsible for the what rivalry, I win all the matches line. You know, it's just great. But I do remember I have the dimmest of memories of watching that final or being aware of it. Certainly my parents would have been more into it than I was at the time. And I remember my mum being appalled at Martina Hingis's behaviour. Appalled. I was probably sat there going, go on, Martina. Do it for stroppy girls everywhere.
But
my mum didn't like it.
There's such an interesting contrast between the immaturity of her attitude and her behaviour and the maturity of her tennis, though. Because her tennis in that first set, especially when she's at her best, is so intelligent, and she meticulously and methodically picks apart the game of Graf, honing in on the weaknesses, manoeuvring her around the court, having the sense of where the next shot's going to land and being there prepared and in time to hit it. And Graf's signature shot, her inside-out forehand, goes straight into Hingis's signature shot, which is her backhand up the line. And time and again, she just dominated the rallies in that respect. And it was her match. It was on her racket, that match, until she let it not be. With the way she got bothered by stuff.
For a set and a half, Hingis looked like just about the complete player. There was no weakness. She was able to, as you say, take on the best of Graf. Give me your best shots. It's fine. I can handle them. And I've always been of the view that Martina Hingis has the best backhand that I've ever seen in women's tennis. I think she could put it anywhere on the court, anytime she wants, from anywhere, and you could bank on it. She was getting inside-out forehands smacked to her backhand, and she was just dismissing them as if they were nothing for clean winners. But that was for a set and a half, or even a set and a bit. And the reaction that you have there, that you've described, Catherine, of your mother's, really takes off early in the second set, where Hingis, for some reason, just self-destructs, because she is a set-up. She's 2-love up with a break, and then there is a close line call on her forehand, which she is insistent is in, and she's pointing down the other end of the court to the umpire and saying, "Go on, check it. It's you've got to check that mark. It's in." Umpire refuses to yield, and Hingis walks around the other side of the net up to the mark and circles it right in Steffi Graf's face, which you are not allowed to do. That is not in the rules. And the French crowd start booing and whistling, and she becomes public enemy number one right there. And I mean, but she's adamant. No, it's, I mean, I think the other day you were saying, Catherine, you could really relate to this idea of frustration if the umpires are not coming down from their chair when you have evidence right in front of you that you are right and it can't be checked. And that's how she looked. Look, it's the evidence is here. I'm going to show you myself. And the reaction from Chris Evert and John McEnroe, who joined the commentary halfway through and was describing Hingis as a genius, that's how he clearly was a huge fan of hers as well. But Chris Evert, I felt, while she rated her, was not impressed with what she was seeing behaviourally. And in fact, in terms of application at times from Hingis, and the view was, you can't do that. That's going to be a point penalty. And sure enough, she got a point penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct.
Well, McEnroe mentioned the D word. Once she traversed the net to the other side, he said, "Oh, that's a default." Well, it certainly is in men's tennis. He wasn't quite calling for it, but he was sort of, it was almost like, well, I would be defaulted for that, so she deserves to be. But actually, it was only a warning. It was the fact that she had had that echoes a little bit here of the 2018 US Open final, but it was actually the racket abuse a few games earlier, which at the time seemed pretty innocuous. It was actually that which stitched her up, because the two combined offences led to the point penalty.
Yeah,
and at the time the sequence was warning, point penalty, match, which McEnroe said he was acutely aware of now, because what was it, 9 years earlier, he'd been defaulted from the Australian Open when he didn't realise that it was warning, point, match. He thought there was a game penalty in there somewhere. But it was funny how the aggro coincided with McEnroe's arrival in the commentary box.
Perfectly timed.
And I also found it funny how Hingis, after going round to check the mark, refused to play on. She sat down on her chair and wanted the referee out, presumably thinking that the referee might make her situation better. But actually, the referee just obviously sided with the umpire and gave her the point penalty. He just made it worse for her.
It was amazing. She looked like, you know, I'll scream and scream and scream till I'm sick.
One of the lovely tangents as well was the referee was Georgina Clark, who's no longer with us, but is somebody that I knew in the very early stages of my career and actually interviewed me once for a job, which I didn't get, but she was absolutely lovely. She was so nice.
Was that in the Lost Law years?
No, it was when I was coming out of them, but I just didn't quite make the grade. but she, Georgina Clark, was somebody that had everybody's respect. She was always came across as fair and calm too, and she came across very calmly in this situation. She understood the emotions are running high out there, and she just very straightforwardly delivered the news to Martina Hingis that no, you're going to get a warning because you're not allowed to go over the other side of the net. And Hingis clearly just didn't know that rule. And if she did know that rule, well, I'm doing it anyway. And that's the air she carried, is that she owned the place. And it, you can understand why it rubbed so many people up the wrong way. She was laughing at her own errors and mocking these situations, including the crowd. And I sensed that she was sort of mocking the fact that, well, I should be able to beat her easily. I mean, God, is that? I mean, she's not that good. I mean, that is the sense I was getting from the Hingis body language. But at the same time, I don't get angry with her for it. I love her for it. I think it's immensely. I see it in kids, in my own kids at times, that sort of response. And it's immaturity, perhaps, but it's very, very funny.
You experienced it dealing with irrational arsiness. And
yes,
entirely rational arsiness, yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, a lot of the time is these reactions are both rational and irrational at the same time, aren't they? You can understand the emotion of it all, and there is a point that, particularly Hingis, she's making a point, and it's a fair one. It's just that it's not actually correct.
And imagine the stress, because a lot of the focus in the commentary was on Steffi Graf and a kind of her resurgence, her potential last hurrah, and of course it was her last hurrah in terms of winning Grand Slams. But Martina Hingis was aiming to complete the career Grand Slam, and there was very little focus on that. And I suspect that's because, you know, and even in all of the post-match speeches and everything, the feeling was, well, if it's not this one, it will be another one. It's inevitable that she will complete the career slam. She's too good not to. She's only 18, time's on her side. So there was so little talk about it. But actually, that is just an enormous, immense thing. You know, think about the next day. Well, we'll be able to talk about this tomorrow, but I rather suspect when we watch the 99 men's final with Agassi and Medvedev, there will be an awful lot more talk about the completion of the career slam for Andre Agassi, yeah, because it had been a longer time coming. It was very much not a foregone conclusion it would happen. But with Hingis, and we'll talk about this with more, the sort of air of tragedy and pathos in all of the post-match commentary about how, well, don't worry, Martina, you will win one. Of course you'll win one. And of course she didn't. She didn't win a French Open.
And in fact, she never won another Grand Slam.
But, you know, just because the commentators weren't talking about it doesn't mean it wasn't the primary thing on Martina Hingis's mind. And the stress of that must have been immense. And she was only 18.
What's interesting as well, she went on from there, all that aggro, and still broke in that second set and was serving for the match. Was it 6-4, 5-4?
Mm.
She served for the match.
Yeah, and she got 15 love. She was 3 points away. She kept having these sort of crises, and you're thinking, well, it's over. She's kind of lost her mind. But then she would recover herself, which actually made it all the more extraordinary that she didn't go on to win this match, because she seemed to get over the emotional problems that she was having and recover her tennis, and then something else would happen. But I think also Graf's reaction to that whole incident at the start of the second set is interesting, because she did noticeably raise her game. She started punching holes, a lot more holes in Hingis's defences. And I think she said afterwards, that was the moment I knew. If she was so fixated on this one point, I knew that she wasn't sort of mentally seeing the big picture and focused. And that was one of the moments where I knew I had her. I knew I had a route back into the match.
And she upped her power noticeably in that period from 5-4 down. And she ended up reeling three games in a row off to win that set, and then won the next one. So that's four games in a row. And then there was that massive toilet break that Hingis took. And one love down in the third set, she goes off the court for, what, 7 minutes? And she comes back on with a completely new hairstyle to boos and whistles from the French crowd.
It was like stars in their eyes. She emerged. She emerged from the locker room looking like a different person.
She did.
tonight I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Perhaps that was her aim. Like, she needed to be a different
person to reinvent herself mid-match.
Yeah.
After a game of the third set. Unfortunately, the just like on Stars in Their Eyes, our broadcast cut out the actual period of transformation. So we were unable to see how Graf was dealing with that period, because by the time she came back out, it looked like Graf was really composed about it. And I'm thinking, lemon heck, I wouldn't be composed, but I'd be losing it over this. But maybe she was while it was happening. But yeah, she came back with her hair in a completely different style, a new scrunchie,
a new top,
completely new outfit. She looked like she'd had a shower. She looked really fresh. And then she's booed and whistled back onto the court. She's taking her sweet time. It's not a it's not a brisk walk. It's more of a sort of lollop back to the chair. And then she has to go and serve. And instead of, you know, making her way swiftly to the service line, she stops halfway to put some clips in her hair. So it's almost like, as much as, you know, at the end of the match, it was very clear how distressing it was for her that the crowd were against her. And this, and McEnroe comments this at the time when she's doing the clips. He says, it's like if there's anybody left in the crowd that hasn't turned against her yet, she's trying to make sure she turns them against her as well. It seemed at the time that she didn't give two hoots, but, you know, later it seemed that hoots were given.
And she gave, it was pretty half-paced tennis she then played. Graf was a runaway train. She did have one break back, but really Graf just accelerated away from her at that point. And Hingis was really erratic. She started missing. She was a step slow to every ball. But the drama wasn't over yet, because when they got to match point, 5-2 for Graf, Hingis serving, match point down, she throws in an underarm serve, almost for an ace.
A great underarm serve.
Michael Chang would have been proud of that. I mean, that was arguably even better than his. It was massively underspun underarm serve that just went sideways when it bounced and won her the point. And the crowd just could not handle that. In fact, when she hit the underarm serve, while the rally was going on, they started booing. And whistling, and then it intensified when she won the point, because they felt like she was just trolling Steffi Graf. They thought she's disrespecting this great champion. Now, we saw no reaction from Graf at that point. Things carry on. There's another match point. There's another saved match point. Hingis has a chance. Then she goes match point down again, and then she hits another underarm serve, which she didn't win the point in. And booing starts again. Hingis goes and has it out with the umpire, I think, about a line call. And then Graf lost it. And Graf comes to the umpire's chair and says, can we just play tennis or what?
I think that what Hingis approached the umpire about was the fact that as she was going to hit the serve, they were still booing and jeering her. Obviously, the crowd were anticipating whether she was going to do the underarm serve again. And she did. But I think Hingis felt that that first serve shouldn't have counted, because I mean it was raucous at the moment she hit that serve.
Yeah, I read it as they were kind of booing her already before she served, and then she served an underarm serve, which was a really bad one, was out, and then she had the confrontation with the umpire, and she was, I can't hear you, umpire, they're all booing me.
She climbed the umpire's chair.
I was holding my breath while that was happening.
And that's when Graf came over and started to have words with Hingis and just say, can we just play or what? And this is at match point. Next point, she's won the title. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen that before, where a player loses a temper with an opponent and then the next point she's celebrating having won her 22nd and final Grand Slam tournament of her career. So she erupts into celebrations. Hingis, suddenly, the emotion of it all overwhelmed her, and the intenseness of it all, and she starts to cry, and she just puts her bag on her shoulder and walks off in a huff, as if she's not going to take any part in the presentation. You can have your French Open title, Steffi. You can lump it, all of you. I'm off. and she just stomps off the court. And the next thing, they go for a break, and Steph is all happy, and they're setting up the massive podium that's now replaced the trophy ceremony in the crowd, which is such a shame. And then after the commercial break, Martina Hingis comes back out onto the court with her mother. Her mother, Melanie Molitor, who's also her coach, who has her arm around her, and she's almost carrying her onto the court, whilst Hingis is sobbing and looking as if she can't really take this whole situation. They then have the presentation to Steffi Graf first as the champion, which is a funny look to us now, isn't it? Because that doesn't happen these days. It's always the runner-up first and then the champion, but it was that way around. And then Hingis just still can't bring herself to be magnanimous about any of it. she's just going, you know, and everything that happens is greeted. Every word that Graf's, even when Graf says, you know, you're going to win one of these one day, she gives a sort of whatever, you know, sort of look to it all.
Well, she knew something that Steffi Graf, Chris Evert, Mary Carrillo, that we're going to hear from, that they didn't. They were all saying, you're going to win one of these. I think Steffi actually said, don't worry about it.
Mm.
And the cameraman's doing a great job at this point because they're both in shot. Steffi's sort of slightly obscuring the crippled face of Martina Hingis. And she just does this eye, this not quite an eye roll, but just enough of a face when Steffi Graf says that. And actually when Steffi's given the microphone, she goes to try and hand it over to Hingis to speak first. And Hingis doesn't even verbally reply. She just does a sort of hand gesture and a face which says, absolutely not.
Although apparently she does speak. We didn't see that on the broadcast, but she does... She does say a few words in French, apparently, to try and get the crowd back on side a little bit. And I think it sort of works. But then in her post-match press conference or interview or something, she seems to make it worse again by saying that the French crowd didn't understand my tennis because I make it look easy. And as much as I do think she brought a lot of it on herself, I did feel slightly sorry for her, particularly when you contrast the reaction to the underarm serve that Michael Chang got. Like, they went wild for that serve,
yeah. And
they booed Martina Hingis doing it. It didn't seem quite fair, I didn't think. I think it was the fact that it was on match point.
Steffi Graf, in her speech, I mean, she was on cloud nine. She described it as the most emotional, the best moment she'd had on a tennis court. She poked the bear that was the Parisian crowd a bit, didn't she? You know, the first thing she did was thank them for their ferocious support. She said, "I feel French today." And they were supporting her, but obviously the elephant in the stadium at that point was that it was also anti-Hingis sentiment.
Mm. I mean, Hingis does make the game look easy. I think she's one of the most talented players I've ever seen, really. And I mean, we'll do it. We're going to do a separate show on her at Wimbledon, and we'll get more into what happened to her thereafter. Because when you watch her play like she did for a set and a half, it's as good as tennis gets, really. I always remember when she was world number one, and I was working at the ATP, and I proposed to the WTA that we do a photo shoot with her and Roger Federer, and they turned me down. They said, she's the world number one. I mean, Roger Federer was this young upstart at the time. But Hingis was just a joy to watch. But she rubbed people up the wrong way, and she did not seem aware of that, really, or aware of why it happened, and also didn't care. So, it was very, very entertaining to watch that. For Graf, though, it was, she was nearing the end of her career. We spoke for this series of shows with Heinz Guntart, her coach, who you may remember we heard from a couple of days ago, who was there right at the start of his time with her, was that 1992 final that Graf had against Monica Seles. And here he was 7 years on, and he said he felt in the final that if Graf could get into the third set, her superior fitness would tell. And although Hingis was dismantling his player by a set and a break, he thought that Hingis's histrionics, particularly going around the other side of the net, would work against her.
I felt at a time, ooh, you know, when you do that, it's almost like a show of force. If you're a teenager, to show like, I can do anything I like, here I go on the other side, and blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, but you're doing it against the wrong player, because this is not going to intimidate her. It's going to do the opposite. It's almost like, oh, you need this so badly? Maybe you're not so certain after all, you know, that kind of thing. And I can't say if that was a turning point, but it was certainly something I felt that helped Steffi, because that also kind of woke up the crowd at the time. And I felt like if here or there, she can just win off some of those points, cut out some of those easy errors in an important moment, this match could turn. In the third, physically, Steffi was too strong for Martina. So as this is slipping away, and Martina felt like, you know, this is my title. I should have won this an hour ago, and now this is happening. Not only are you losing, the whole stadium wants you to lose. I mean, that must have been an extremely difficult situation to handle for a teenager, and she couldn't.
Once Steffi had won that title, that was her final Grand Slam title, 22nd singles slam. 12th with you. Where do you feel that ranked for her and for you versus all the others?
It was very, very emotional, I have to say, because there is such a difficult time prior to that because of all the injuries. It was completely unclear if she was going to be able to play again. And once she started playing, it wasn't like she was 100%, not even close. So we didn't know how long she was going to be able to play either. So the combination of not even knowing if you're going to be there, then able to win, not knowing if it's the last time you're there, it certainly adds to something. And it makes the title even more special. I think every single one was special, but that one kind of stands out because it could have been the last hurrah, and it turned out it was.
She went on to Wimbledon, and she reached the final. She beat Venus Williams, she beat Kim Clijsters, a young Kim Clijsters, and lost eventually to Lindsay Davenport in the final. And as you say, people perhaps don't know where she finished her career. Well, it was just a few weeks later in Carlsbad. And it was first round against Amy Frazier, third set, retired at 1-2. What are your memories of that? I mean, was it immediate? Was it clear that this is the end?
It was, because, as I mentioned to you, it wasn't like she was 100% or close to it, neither at the French nor at Wimbledon. You know, things were breaking down here and there. You know, knee, back, all kinds of things. So daily practice was very, very difficult to find the right amount. You know, how much are you supposed to hit balls? I remember going out for a jog and suddenly we had to stop because her back was hurting, that kind of thing. When I arrived there in the first practice session, that wasn't her. There was absolutely no joy hitting balls. I mean, if it was like, okay, we had to be out there and we're going to play in a couple of days' time, but that practice had nothing to do with any practice session we had prior to that. So I felt like there wasn't the energy there used to be. And she was basically asking herself, what am I doing here? So I was not surprised at all when she walked off the court injured again, saying, I think I had it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's amazing to hear it from the horse's mouth, isn't it, really? From somebody who was there at the time, at the end of a player's career. And I find it so interesting. We were watching and talking about Michael Chang the other day, and I was telling you about probably a three-year period at the end of his career when really it felt like he should have stopped a long time before he did, in terms of how I viewed it from the outside. Now, it's always up to the individual, as Hines said there. You've got to make your own mind up. Michael Chang was winning a handful of matches and losing dozens in a year at the end of his career. Here's Steffi Graf, whose final three tournaments, one French Open, final Wimbledon, first round retired. Those are the three tournaments she played right at the end. There are not many like that. I mean, people always point to Pete Sampras going out on the top and winning the US Open and then retiring. But actually, he had, I think, 9 months of just trying to play again, trying to train again, but just suddenly finding he'd got no motivation left and it just wasn't there anymore for him. So he ummed and ahed for a long time. With Graf, yeah, I mean, I think it kind of goes that she was that decisive about it in the end. But it does hit you, doesn't it, when we consider what we've just witnessed, that incredible high, that incredible achievement, and then actually I've got nothing left.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly powerful stuff from Hines Gunter there. I found that I was hanging on every word. What a shame Steffi Graf wasn't able to retire with a mixed doubles Wimbledon title alongside John McEnroe. That could have been her last hurrah, not a first round in Carlsbad.
Yes, because McEnroe, halfway through the commentary of the match that we've just watched, comes into the commentary box and says, she's agreed. She's going to play mixed doubles with me at Wimbledon in a couple of weeks' time. And of course, that's what happened. As well as playing the singles and reaching the final and losing to Lindsay Davenport, she joined forces with John McEnroe, who'd retired 7 years earlier as a singles player, but was very active on the Champions Tour. That's when I was traveling around with that tour, and he was playing incredibly good tennis back then, particularly for a guy of his age. And he was so pumped to be playing with Steffi Graf. He was like a little boy who'd just been told that he could go in a sweet shop and have whatever he wants for the rest of the day. And he was just fired up, and they were a good doubles partnership, and they beat Justin Gilmerstub and Venus Williams. They beat other good partnerships, and they were on their way. And then she made it into the final, and she physically decided she couldn't do both and pulled out of that mixed doubles with John McEnroe. And he has never forgiven her. I don't think he's even forgiven her now for that. It hurt him. It cut him so deep that she pulled out of that. I mean, it sounds funny, doesn't it, really? But he was so upset.
Well, that's one of my favourite stories.
Yeah, mine too.
I wonder if she regrets that now. Don't know.
I'd love to know.
No?
I wouldn't have thought so, really. I think she knew her own mind. I mean, I understand it from his position, but I also understand it from her position. But I think he felt that she'd committed to him and she'd agreed that she would play no matter what. I think he felt that she was going back on what they'd agreed. Maybe he's not so bothered now, but you know what John is like. He's so intense. He's so determined. And he wanted to win again. He had another chance.
Maybe that's why she's not a presence in tennis anymore. She's afraid of bumping into John McEnroe.
It's quite interesting. A few years later, when, because Andre Agassi obviously had a number of really good years that followed, won multiple Grand Slam titles whilst Steffi Graf had retired by then. And when she would come back to the circuit, you could see this serenity that had come over her, having made that decision, having no longer got to think about competing and the stress. You see this from time to time, don't you? When somebody comes back when they've retired at the right time, and that they're ready for it in their lives. And she and Andre got married, and she had other interests and sort of worked incredibly hard together on their schools that they've put together in Las Vegas. And she became a mother fairly soon afterwards to Jaden and Jazz. And I remember watching them on when we were in the commentary box up high in the Australian Open on the Melbourne Arena. I remember her coming out to the practice court while he was hitting and just playing tennis with the little lad when he was just a toddler, Jaden Gill. And she just looked so relaxed. And relaxed is not something that you could really describe Steffi Graf as during her career, as I recall it. And from all the versions of events that I've heard from people that knew her over the years. But it was the right time for her to retire.
But I think you also see the opposite sometimes. I think retiring because you've lost motivation or you just doesn't feel right anymore to keep going is actually a really difficult thing to get right. We see a lot of players retire and then come back because they can't fill that hole in their life, or they're not ready for their second phase of their life.
Hingis.
Exactly. It's great for Steffi Graf that she did manage to call it at exactly the right time.
And she's cultivated a potential Major League Baseball player.
Yeah, Jaden Gill is quite a baseball player.
Not sure cultivated was the right was the right verb there. Is that a verb one uses for child rearing? No.
Well, we know what you mean, Catherine. It's all right. Let's get a final word about Martina Hingis as well. As I said, we'll go deep into her career in the show that we do during Wimbledon. But we can't finish this without a word from Mary Carrillo, who covered Hingis' career throughout. Let's hear what she thought of her.
I really enjoyed watching her. The eye of the tiger, as Nick Politeri would say. The nose of the elephant. I mean, that kid was such a... She had so much variety, and she knew just when to use it. And she was pretty slight compared. That's what ended up happening, by the way, to my mind, when I keep talking about the mental strength of the greats. Then the game became very physical. And Hingis, I think the blunt force trauma of so many players who were able to hit through her is what got her way. But back then, when she was just a kid, and she was so clever, and she managed the court so well. There was no real place to attack her because she knew how to make the most of her strokes and her mind. I mean, she had a beautiful mind for the game. Oh, I loved watching Hingis play. It didn't surprise me. I mean, the one that got away for her, obviously, is against Graf at the French in 99. And that was kind of remarkable to see her not figure out a way to win that one. And what's interesting about that one, okay, it's 16 at Wimbledon, she doesn't have a lot of pressure. Then she wins herself the U.S. Open. She shows what she can do in Australia. But the French, that she never won the French, I mean, which is the service she grew up on. And when Graf beats her and says, I'll never play this again, like Graf already knew where that was in her lineup, But Hingis, I still felt like, well, Hingis is going to win. She'll win a French.
Yeah, and she didn't. She didn't. And I think Mary says what we were all thinking. And Steffi Graf said it to her face in front of 17,000 people. You'll win one of these. And she didn't. Amazing, really.
She didn't win another slam, which is... Yeah. And I know that the narrative is, and Mary alluded to it there, that the power game came along and it squeezed Martina Hingis out. You know, the Davenports that, of course, most notably the Williams sisters. But actually she had punched her way through Steffi Graf, who, okay, she wasn't the Williams sisters, but she was a power player. You know, that was, she was in the end, as you say, she started injecting more pace on the ball in that second set. Steffi Graf found a way to make her ball striking, her power play tell in that match. So I think it's a sort of slightly reductive narrative to say that sort of Martina Hingis's game just kind of faded into sort of feebleness with the wave of power tennis. I mean, obviously that is true to a certain degree, but she was doing it against big hitters as well. She at her peak, she was.
More was going on there.
And of course, the year before, this isn't talked about enough, the year before at the French, when she lost, I think, in the semis, she was going for the four slams in a row. She was going for the Hingis slam, the whatever we call it. What do we call it? The Djokovic slam, the Serena slam.
Serena slam, yeah. So there we are. Martina Hingis, we'll have a full show on her during Wimbledon. Steffi Graf, we've had two wonderful conversations about her. And tomorrow we'll be talking about Andre Agassi as he tried to complete the career Grand Slam up against Andre Medvedev. That incredible year, 1999. More of that coming your way.
Matt, I will be expecting stats on how often two players with the same name have faced one another. No pressure.
It's not quite the same name, though, is it?
Yeah. It sounds the same.
Not sure you can have that, Catherine. But anyway, we'll have a look on stats on that. No problem. We've got the right man for the job. We'll be back with another one tomorrow. I hope you're enjoying these editions of Tennis Relived from the French Open. We'll have many more of them coming your way over week two of what should have been Roland Garros. But we're going back in time once again for 1999 tomorrow. Do tell your friends if you're enjoying this. Thanks for your company today, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.